Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Budget showdown this week. Democrats, GOP, Tea Party, all in the fight. And Japan rocked again by its biggest aftershock yet. Government shutdown and a whole lot of spending on the line in Washington. Here's the president late last night.
My hope is that I'll be able to announce to the American people sometime relatively early in the day that a shutdown has been averted, that a deal has been completed, that has very meaningful cuts in a wide variety of categories.
Lots of finger-pointing, blame, and a shut-it-down cry in the air. Here's Republican Congressman Mike Pence of Indiana at a Tea Party rally.
If liberals in the Senate would rather play political games and force a government shutdown instead of accepting a modest down payment on fiscal discipline and reform, I say shut it down.
And another earthquake, 7.1 this time, hit northeast Japan on Thursday as the nation still struggles to recover. An office building in Sendai shook as the quake hit. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable, with Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, Ron Brownstein of the National Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Ron Brownstein is political director, columnist for the National Journal, author of The Second Civil War. Ron Brownstein, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be here, Tom.
It's great to have you. Karen Tumulty is political reporter for The Washington Post. Karen, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
And Jack, great to have you here. What a week.
Indeed it was.
Karen, this thing is still rolling. There's no getting around that. We're talking about this in real time. What does it look like as we talk right now? And things may change, but is this government shutting down, partially shutting down? What appears to be happening, Karen?
Well, everybody is very, very excruciatingly close. In terms of money, only a few billion dollars separate the two sides. Now, how you spend that money, there is still some difference. For instance, the Republicans want to see more of this in defense spending than the White House does. It is so close that, you know, quite my gut's telling me it's hard to see them forcing a shutdown when they've come this far.
Ron Brownstein, what are you hearing? What are you feeling? Is it still hanging over Washington, over the country?
Well, it certainly is still hanging over Washington and the country, but I agree with Karen. I think the feeling among my colleagues who have been immersed in this for the last 72 hours is that they will find a way to keep the government open. But having said that, you know, politics isn't always rational. And there is enormous centrifugal pressure in the House Republican caucus to draw the hardest deal possible. We've talked about it before. These new members believe they were sent here to confront, not compromise with President Obama. And while the leadership, I think, in the White House, the Senate, and especially John Boehner do not want a shutdown, and all signs, I think, suggest they can avoid it, I would not entirely guarantee it because of the unpredictable nature of that House Republican caucus.
Jack, listen to a couple of different perspectives on this from a Democrat, from a Republican here. First, Dick Durbin, Democratic Senator, Illinois, accusing Congress, Republicans in Congress here, of focusing more on issues, hobby horses, on policy than on reducing the deficit in the debate over the budget. Here's Durbin.
This is no longer about the budget deficit. It's about bumper stickers. It's about your favorite issue from years gone by that you want to debate and litigate in this budget resolution, this critical resolution in terms of the future of our country and our government. It's time for Speaker Boehner to acknowledge that we have an agreement. We are going to reduce the deficit for the remainder of this year. And he has to tell his Tea Party Rough Riders to put their horses in the barn.
Rough Riders, put your horses in the barn, but it doesn't sound like the Tea Party wants to get back in the barn. Here's Michelle Bachmann, Republican, Minnesota Congresswoman, founder of the House Tea Party Caucus, maybe gunning for the presidency in 2012. Here she was talking at a rally on Wednesday anyway, downplaying the impact of a potential government shutdown.
We want to be perfectly clear. There is no such thing as an actual government shutdown. There isn't, because we know that Social Security checks will continue to go out. the military will continue to go forward. And we also know that that there will be a very large number of government employees that will stay on the job. Yeah. Some will be furloughed, but they will stay on the job. So let's just be clear, first of all, it is a government slowdown. There is no such thing as a shutdown.
Tea Party Power, Michelle Bachmann. There's no such thing as a government shutdown, Jack. It's the tooth fairy.
It's just a slowdown.
Where are we headed here?
Well, you know, I think what's driving Michelle Bachmann and the Republicans is this poll result this week. You can see it's 68% of self-identified Tea Party people want no compromise. 56% of self-identified Republicans compared to 66% of independents who want a compromise. That's just a very tough political algebra for Mr. Boehner. And the two issues that at least reportedly have been policy writers that have been holding things up, those are so colored by emotion and by interest. The abortion riders on Planned Parenthood and abortion in the District of Columbia, that caucus in the House, according to David Rogers today, that's really been the real problem, one of the real problems that the anti-choice pro-life caucus in the House, that's really been driving the no compromise on Boehner. And then on the other side, the freshmen, freshmen receive more money from the Koch interests than any other group. They owe a lot to that.
You're talking about the Koch brothers here
Koch
with
brothers,
their big industrial interest?
Yeah, and they want nothing more than to get the EPA out of their business.
Karen Timmelty, bring us as far as forward as we can on where this thing stands. I mean, the latest I'm reading here is that Democrats have agreed at this point to $37 billion in cuts. I mean, it was on Wednesday, John Boehner was looking for $39 billion in spending cuts, only, I don't know, $1.5 billion or so more than Democrats apparently were willing to offer overnight last night. I mean, if it's that narrow, where does it appear to stand on the money? And what about these policy issues, the so-called riders, Karen?
Well, my understanding in talking to people on the Hill is that the Republicans, these riders are basically bargaining chips, and the Republicans are ready to jettison most of them. But what they want in return are additional spending cuts, and apparently that is one of the sticking points at this point. And again, it's not just the numbers, it's the composition. How much of this comes out of defense, for instance? How much of this comes out of mandatory programs versus discretionary spending? But again, I'm back to where I started. I think both sides went into this believing that it was not in anybody's interest for there to be a government shutdown. And what I mean by that is a real big, long government shutdown. You know, if it's shut down over the weekend, I don't think that many people notice. But I think there's everybody's looking for a way out of this.
Ron, what might that look like? I mean, they haven't come out of there smiling from all these White House meetings yet. As far as we know, the policy writers are still in there, you know, no regulation of greenhouse gases by the EPA, no funds for this financial regulation, health care reform, and on down Planned Parenthood, abortion. Right. What are you hearing about the negotiations themselves and where they may have come to, Ron?
Well, first of all, Democrats are happy to focus on those riders, particularly the one defunding Planned Parenthood. Chuck Schumer has been on television basically saying that is the big holdup, and obviously Democrats believe that is a winning issue for them with their constituency. You know, as we've talked about before, college-educated mm-hmm. white women are pretty much the one reliably Democratic part of the white electorate. New polls out yesterday, for example, in Pew Research Center underscoring that. So I think that it is unlikely. I think the Democrats would feel very comfortable taking a hard line on those policy riders. Obama has shown much less enthusiasm about defending the EPA regulation of carbon, which was never his preferred way to deal with that problem, and was remarkably silent on votes in the Senate and in the House this week directly on that issue. But they did put out a statement saying, you know, they obviously oppose using the appropriations process to block the EPA from doing that. I think that they, by and large, they believe that they have more leverage on these riders than the Republicans do, and that if the Republicans are seen, if there's a deal on the size of the cuts and it is insistence on the riders that is shutting down the government, I think they would be perfectly content with that outcome. And it doesn't look as though John Boehner disagrees that much with that conclusion. So, you know, I'm with Karen. I mean, it feels like everybody in at the top of the pyramid is trying to find a way out of a full-scale shutdown. Boehner understands and recognizes that the shutdown in 95, 96 was when Bill Clinton went back ahead of Bob Dole in the polls, never trailed again after the second government shutdown in any Gallup poll the rest of 96. It's a huge roll of the dice. But, you know, these things are not always easy to control, as we saw during the TARP vote in the fall of 2008. So, yes, I think the logic of the people in charge is let's not jump off this precipice, but they may not be able to avoid getting pushed off of it by a stampede behind them, perhaps.
Top of the pyramid, Jack, trying to make a deal, maybe, but Ron's exactly right. I mean, there's a lot of pressure from the Tea Party and at this point from Democrats as well, looking at that $33, $35, $37 billion, whatever it is, and saying enough already on the cuts.
Yes, you know, I've been surprised we haven't heard more of that from Democrats. I've heard some liberals complain about that, the amount of money and so on, but I haven't. It hasn't been as big an issue. It's strange when you look around. I mean, it's Republicans some who are raising issues about the size of these cuts. For example, Michael Gerson in today's Washington Post points to cuts that in foreign aid that would prevent anti-malarial drugs and nets from going to the third world could cost thousands of people their lives. He's actually making an issue of that. I haven't seen that from the Democrats.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. Budget showdown in Washington barreling maybe into a government shutdown. Ron, Karen, Jack, here's John Boehner on ABC News. This was an interview on Wednesday. He was talking with George Stephanopoulos about the role of the Tea Party in negotiations over the budget, his relationship there, whether there's any light between them, daylight between them.
I'm going to fight for the best deal I can for my team.
You know what the Democrats say? They say they could cut a deal with you, but you won't buck the Tea Party.
Listen, there's no daylight between the Tea Party and me.
None?
None. They want us to deal with this crushing debt that's going to crush the future for our kids and grandkids. There's no daylight there.
There's no daylight between the Tea Party and me, House Speaker John Boehner there. Now, Karen, we've talked with the Tea Party member this week saying no way he wanted Boehner to stand down on the riders, on the policy issues. What about that claim, no daylight there? Is that just public image management? Could that be real?
Well, first of all, when you're in the middle of a negotiation, nobody is going to say that anything can be,
my team's
can be compromised. And I think at some point, Speaker Boehner is going to go to his caucus, including all these freshman members who got elected with a lot of Tea Party support, and he is going to say, look, we've said we'd cut $100 billion off of where things stood a year ago. We got to $80 billion. This is what victory looks like. But more importantly, this is neither the first nor the most important fight we're going to have this year. This fight is a skirmish compared to what the fight over the 2012 budget is going to look like and potentially what the fight over lifting the debt ceiling is going to look like. So, you know, this is not the end for them.
Wow, if this is a skirmish, everybody.
Tom, I think that is the correct point. You know, I'm usually leery of World War II analogies, but as everyone should be. But, you know, if they come out today with a deal on this spending through October, it really is kind of a peace in our time moment that is not, in fact, an augur of sustained peace, because the Republican budget that they put out this week. That Paul Ryan released earlier this week.
The longer term
2012 and beyond budget really is the main event here, because I think it articulates in a more integrated and comprehensive way than we've really seen, I think, even going back to Ronald Reagan, a long-term conservative vision of retrenching the role of Washington in society, fundamentally changing the safety net so that Americans are more reliant on the market mm-hmm. rather than government for their retirement security, literally ending Medicare as it now exists and replacing it with a premium support or voucher system, block granting Medicaid, historic levels of reduction in domestic discretionary spending, severe limits on both government revenue and spending. That is a fundamental, as fundamental a divide as you can imagine. And of course, it has very little chance of becoming law, no chance of becoming law while President Obama is president and the Democrats control a majority in the Senate, but it does put a marker down in the ground and probably widens the differences between the parties in 2012, because you're already seeing places like the Wall Street Journal editorial page saying that any Republican presidential candidate, the test of their seriousness on the deficit mm-hmm. should be whether they are willing to endorse these proposals. And I think it is highly likely that every Republican candidate will have to support this and will probably run in 2012 on converting Medicare into a voucher and ending the program as it now exists, which is a huge roll of the dice at a time when Republicans have become more dependent on the votes of white seniors than at any point. You know, in 2010, they won a higher share of the senior vote than they've won in any congressional election in the last 30 years of exit polls. So this is a huge roll of the dice. It's also a huge clarifying ideological space between the parties, of which Karen says this is really the foothill next to that mountainous dispute that's coming down the road.
But Ron, on a narrow point there, I mean, you're outlining a huge conflict still coming at us, but on the narrow point of seniors, I mean, Paul Ryan has carefully carved out 55-plus
yes.
Americans. They will face no change, so maybe that's fine for the GOP.
Good luck with that. Yes, he has, and that, I think, clearly reflects the political reality of a Republican Party that is doing increasingly well with white seniors. They won about three-fifths of them in both the 2008 presidential election, 2010 House election. They now, by the way, hold two-thirds, we reported today in National Journal, two-thirds of the House districts with the highest proportion of seniors. That's where they made a lot of their gains in 2010. And he has carved them out, but it is not easy to make those kinds of distinctions about a transition. Democrats are going to be running ads saying that so-and-so member of Congress voted to literally end Medicare as it now exists and replace it with a voucher. They are not going to be telling voters, oh, by the way, this doesn't affect anybody until 2022. That policy defense is there. Politically, that is going to be a big challenge to make clear, because the likelihood is that virtually all as I've talked to Republican members, I'd be interested in what Karen thinks. The likelihood is that virtually all House Republicans are going to vote for this budget, which will put them on record supporting these reductions, including, most importantly, literally ending the Medicare program as it now exists and replacing it with a voucher or premium support.
Karen, Jack, I want to get you on that. We have a lot of listeners, though, here waiting to come in. Madison, Wisconsin, Paul Ryan-ish country. Daniel, you're on the air. Dan?
I've been reminded of Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And I see what's going on in Wisconsin. You could say the same thing to Wisconsin voters, which have been going on. And this whole thing about people voting against their own best interest, and I think we're seeing that, and I'm wondering if any of your commentators see that from Thomas Frank's book and some other ones that he's written, and I know he writes a column.
But Daniel, what about voters and your fellow Wisconsin yes. voters who look at the deficit and say, this is just too much? We've got to do something about this for our own interest, Daniel.
Yeah, well, seeing that in Wisconsin with Governor Walker and the storm he riled up with the collective bargaining rights
yes.
being taken away, but also about $1 billion taken away from education just for one thing. There's a real storm going on in Wisconsin, and the recent election, especially the Supreme Court election, which is in turmoil and really split, I think I see a lot of people in the framework that Thomas Frank talked about in his book about Kansas. I think I see that widening, and I think the American electorate just doesn't pay attention. It pays only attention to the glitz in the media and too many sound bites.
Daniel, you may be right, but Ron, at the same time, there's a lot of people looking at that deficit and saying, hell or high water, we want to pull that down.
Yeah, there's a broader point, though. Thomas, what's the matter with Kansas is that it only gets half of the picture. It is true that over the past generation, blue-collar white voters have voted increasingly Republican. John McCain won 58% of white voters without a college education. That's the part that Thomas Franks focus on. He argues that Republicans are diverting them with bread and circuses, cultural issues, and so forth. But the other half of the equation is equally true. And what we're living through is really a class inversion. At the same time that blue-collar whites have been voting more Republican, white-collar upper middle-class whites have been voting more Democratic. Both ends of the income spectrum have been voting, quote, against their class interests because Democrats now do better among white voters whose taxes probably would be raised by many of their policies. Pew polling yesterday, Barack Obama running 47% approval among white voters with a college education, only 34% on those without. In fact, you see over and again enormous skepticism in that working-class white community that any of these government programs will ultimately benefit them. You could look at the polling on health care. Blue-collar whites are uninsured at a much higher level than white-collar, college-educated whites, but they were also much more skeptical that health care would ever benefit them. So what we're seeing here in reaction to this, I think, to this fight, is this kind of larger, what I called a class inversion in our politics, which is pretty unique in the Western world, where you have the college-educated, more upper-middle-class, at least white constituency that is more favorable to Democrats than that blue-collar constituency. And that is something that is not a new phenomenon. It is, but it is deepening in this confrontation, and indeed deepening in general in the Obama presidency, because he really struggles, and Democrats are really struggling with that white working class constituency in these last few years.
Let me get another caller, Iowa, Alan, calling from Tama, Iowa. You're on the air, Alan.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My opinion is that there's too many people that are dependent on government money, both in spending and as well as procurement, and people should learn to get along without it.
So, do you say shut it down if that's what it takes to get a bigger cut in the budget, Alan, or not?
I'm prepared to go forward. There's a lack of leadership of the people, and you know, I look back to 100 years ago when they started the Lincoln Highway Association, and they started building the highways with private money, no government. If it's good enough to be done, we can do it. I'll start with the national parks. We'll start running the national parks. We do not need that government to spend all that money.
Alan, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, there's the attitude. You can draw a line from that to Paul Ryan's 2012 budget and beyond. Mm-hmm. Let's just fundamentally change the role of government in this country, Jack, and really whack it back. Let people build the highways.
Yes, and Paul Krugman points out today that the Ryan budget would actually put the country almost back in terms of percentages to where it was in domestic spending under Calvin Coolidge. Cal the silent, Cal the frugal. I understand Alan's point. I mean, a lot of people feel there's too much spending, but, you know, the fact is that the federal government just can't disappear. 45% of all spending is by the federal government, and it's part of the whole economic, health system, really. It keeps things going. And I'm sure the Chinese would love us to say we want to go back to privatizing everything. We want to get the government out of everything, out of education, out of the IR, whatever it is. They would be delighted because the chances of our then becoming a successful successful on the international scene, where infrastructure, research, and education are the key variables, that would be undermined.
Karen Templeton, what about the politics? I mean, there's two calls and two views, in 95, the Democrats won after a shutdown. Everybody finally concluded. But what about this time? How do you see it lining up, Karen? If it comes to a shutdown, the country has to make a judgment. Who called this right? Who called this wrong? Is it clear that the Democrats win this time or not?
Well, the polling going in suggests that the public would blame everybody. But one thing that I found interesting in talking to Democrats over the last few days is that one of their fears is, what if there's a government shutdown and nobody notices?
Social Security checks still go out.
Well, and so much is now automated that wasn't in 1995. And also, a lot of functions of government in the post 9/11 era would be deemed necessary for national security. The TSA didn't exist in the last government shutdown. So their fear is that, a short-term government shutdown, if it doesn't kind of bite into people's daily lives pretty quickly. It would actually, you know, reinforce arguments like the one that Alan is making.
Of course, here's President Obama tweaking the Republicans. This was a speech in Pennsylvania on Wednesday. Republicans who have talked for a long time now about how the Obama administration has brought uncertainty, and that's bad for business, that's bad for the economy. This week, the president was seemed almost cheekily eager to turn that around, saying the threat of a shutdown raises that uncertainty.
Companies don't like uncertainty, and if they start seeing that suddenly we may have a shutdown of our government, that could halt momentum right when we need to build it up, all because of politics. I do not want to see Washington politics stand in the way of America's progress. At a time when you're struggling to pay your bills and meet your responsibilities, the least we can do is meet our responsibilities to produce a budget.
Ron Brownstein, there's the president throwing that one right back at the Republicans. Does that have political legs here? Are Americans going to say, yes, we've got a little something going on with the economy? This is the thing that could kick the, you know, the braces out from beneath it. President's right.
I think the reaction will be less about the economy than about compounding the sense of Washington as a dysfunctional place that can't meet even its basic responsibilities. As you pointed out, the 95-96 showdown really was – shutdown was a turning point in what had been a Republican ascendancy in 94, Clinton's slide through the 93-94 period. Clinton went back over 50% in approval during the second government shutdown, went ahead of Bob Dole in the polls, and never trailed him again. It really was the end in all practical terms for the 96 election. There's no guarantee this would turn out as well for President Obama. For one thing, President Clinton had established a different predicate because he had come out with his own plan to balance the budget, and he could basically say we're arguing not about whether but how. That's not something that President Obama can say. And I think that both sides are really uncertain about how this would play out. And I think that neither one is particularly anxious to roll the dice, which takes us back to what Karen was saying before, that in the end, both are kind of leery of leaping off this precipice because they don't know what's waiting for them down below.
It's amazing, Jack, that we've come so far when there does seem to be that much mystery about how this actually plays. This is big poker for sort of blindness on the pot.
Yes, but one thing is certain, and I'm not attributing this design to the Republicans, but let's be candid. Objectively, their interest is to keep this recovery as muted as possible. I mean, the higher the unemployment is next year, the more difficult it is for Mr. Obama to be reelected. There's a vested interest in slowing things down on the Republican side. And everything that creates uncertainty, everything that creates, well, you know, people have contracts with the federal government, can't go ahead with it. People around the national parks, they can't sell their gewgaws. You know, all up and down the economy. Then all the employees who won't be able to spend their money, all of that creates not just uncertainty, but actual negative economic consequences.
Karen, when do you think, or maybe we're there now, maybe John Boehner is going to be talking with the Tea Party today and saying this is enough, guys and gals, but in the Tea Party itself, do you see awareness of danger here on the political side or just a determination to push ahead come what may?
You know, in talking to people who've been talking to Tea Party members in Congress, I do sense a level of, I'll use a word that they will hate, pragmatism, that you don't hear sometimes in their rhetoric. Again, they are going to know that if getting to $80 billion when you promised $100 billion, most people are going to look at that as a victory. Or getting to, you know, $40 billion, depending on where you're counting from. And it's one of these things where they understand, too, that at some point the voters are going to say, you know, why don't you people take yes for an answer?
Why wouldn't this number or that number be enough? It is incredible that the gap has gotten so small and still they can't get around it. I mean, Ron, the Democrats have come a long way from where this thing started out.
Yes.
Of course, the deficit's so big, it's still just a tiny piece of that.
Right, and because discretionary spending is only about a seventh of the overall budget, and ultimately the decisions that we made on entitlements and revenues. You know, federal revenue this year as a share of the economy is at the lowest level since 1950, which is not only before Medicare and Medicaid and federal aid to education, but before the interstate highway system that one of our callers wanted to undo. So, you know, most analysis has said you need a balanced package, Simpson-Bowles, Domenici-Rivlin, the two bipartisan commissions that have looked at this. You need revenue. revenue and spending. Right now, Paul Ryan and the Republicans want to deal with it only on the spending side. That's a recipe for conflict with Democrats and a sharp polarization in the country over the rest agenda for how to deal with this.
Ron, stand by. Karen Temple, Jack Beatty. We're looking at a week in the news and budget showdown. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the Libyan woman who cried gang rape to the world, Iman Obeidi, told NPR it's a nightmare there under Muammar Gaddafi.
There is no law. This is a country with no law, she says. This is a country of gangs.
And the fighting goes on. Scrutiny of the nation's Boeing 737s this week after a Southwest Air passenger jet ripped open in flight. Here's Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood.
We can't allow planes to be blowing holes in their roof while people are at 30,000 feet. We just can't.
No, we cannot. And Bob Dylan plays Beijing. A young Chinese concert goer spoke about what the musician meant to her.
A lot of people like him. They've grown up with his music, especially his anti-war songs and his songs about human rights. We all really identify with them. I didn't really think about the political impacts, but more about how his music influenced our life and how he's an inspiration to us.
There must be some way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief.
A long way from Washington right there, but the action is in Washington this week. Budget showdown, barreling toward government shutdown. Ron Brownstein of the National Journal joins us this hour. Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post and our own Jack Beatty is here. Lots of response online. Rob says, you know, this is not about numbers. This is a seizing an opportunity to exercise ideological vendettas against, you know, Planned Parenthood and all the rest. What do you think? Stuart in Omaha, Nebraska. Stuart, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, what's going on in Washington right now is a good view of what class and racial conflict or warfare looks like. You know, most of the programs that the conservatives want to cut benefit poor and unfortunate people, and due to the historical discrimination in this country, most of those people will be non-white. You know, one of your panelists alluded to earlier that Barack Obama was having problems with the so-called working-class whites.
Yeah.
Well, usually that's because, you know, most of those working-class whites, you know, harbor a lot of racial animosity, you know, due to, you know, like programs like, what's the name of that program, Affirmative Action. You know, and yep. He also said that, you know, well-to-do whites, you know, are usually voting Democrat. That's because through their education, they know that, you know, if the poor are denied, you know, access to opportunity, chances are that will lead to what, you know, class warfare actually is.
Stuart, what do you say, Stuart, to voters, white or not, who say, okay, but we're just spending too much and it's going to drag us all down, white, brown, black, you name it. What do you say to that argument?
Well, what I say to that argument is that provide more opportunity, you know, and discrimination and provide more opportunity to people so that way they can move up the social ladder and pay taxes. You know, and on top of that, you know, realize that, you know, the population of this country is far greater than what it was in 1776 or 1789, you know, when the Constitution was written. So more services are going to be needed, you know.
Yes, it's not the beginning anymore, that's for sure. Stuart, I appreciate your call. Jack, I mean, in the end, presidential elections, anyway. Let's think about 2012 here for a second. They have tended to come down to independent voters and which way they are swayed. I mean, Ron and Karen are pointing out this is going to be a super polarized scene on the other side of this, very likely. They're going to make the difference. Who gets swayed here, Jack?
Well, the polls suggest that on the shutdown, the independents are overwhelmingly in favor of a compromise. Tea Party members overwhelmingly in favor of no compromise. And I think that there's a straw in the wind that connects these issues of what is the temperament of the Republican base voter, or but to be more specific, the Tea Party voter. This week, in polls showing that Donald Trump, of all people, it leads among self-identified Tea Party members as their preferred candidate for president. Now, his whole candidacy may just be a joke, something to boost the ratings. Nevertheless, what's he known for? What has he made salient? The racially, I think, charged idea that President Obama is not a legitimate president because he was not born in this country, this birtha lie. That's a very, it's just very hard to even think about how anyone public person could spew that nonsense. But he's speaking to some constituency. That constituency may drive the Republican Party too far to the right.
Well, if I can get Karen in here for just a second, Ron, on this center of gravity issues and independence. I mean, how are you reading that, Karen, with all this buffeting here? That almost always makes the difference in the presidential election.
Well, I do think the polls are pretty clear that independents want to see government function, and they want to see these guys come to some kind of deal. But they also turned pretty hard against Barack Obama in the last election because they did see government spending growing. Because, as the earlier caller was saying, because of social programs, what they objected to were bailouts for Wall Street, bailouts for the automakers. Mm-hmm. They are seeing their own state and local governments getting squeezed and their taxes going up. And it just feels like too much. And beyond that, I thought the most salient number in the polls during last year's election was the fact that if you asked people whether they or someone in their family had lost a job within the last 12 months, 4 out of 10 people were saying yes. And so basically, they want Washington to just fix this.
Just fix it. But of course, it's all about the how, Ron, and the hows are headed in opposite directions.
Well, Tom, can I just pull back the lens half a step here? Because I thought what your caller Stuart was talking about was really, in fact, much more profound than the immediate fight. The census came out about 10 days ago with its final numbers, and it shows we are living through a profound change. The next America is arriving ahead of schedule. 37%, almost 37% of the overall population is now minority. The minority share of the population increased in every state from 2000 to 2010. So it's not just a phenomenon in Los Angeles, Dallas, and Phoenix. It's really diffusing through the country. And two things are happening at once. The society is growing more brown and more gray. The under 18 population is now almost 47% non-white, whereas the senior population, which we talked about before, is increasingly Republican, remains preponderantly white because there was essentially no immigration in the country between 1924 and 1965. And this is a baked-in structural conflict in our politics that is going to be here in 2012, was here in 2008, and is going to be here for a long time because you have this burgeoning non-white youth population whose families believe they need public investment in education, healthcare, infrastructure to lift them into the middle class, and you have an older white population that is moving to the right and is growing increasingly resistant to paying for this. And if you want to get a sense of what this looks like, I was in Texas last week in a state where 2/3 of the kids in the public schools are now minority, actually 70% are now minority, and they are looking at over 20% cuts in state contributions to education because the Republican governor and legislature will not raise taxes a dime to close an enormous budget shortfall. And I think that, we saw a huge gap in 2008. Obama won 80% of minority voters, only 43% of whites. That gap could be even larger in 2012. And we do have a structural conflict in attitudes rooted in very different views about what people are willing to pay for out of government that is not going away and is going to probably only intensify as this demographic change continues.
I mean, people want to cut the budget, but if it's 2/3 of kids not getting educated, that's not just a minority issue. That's an issue for the whole economy. Stan in Nashville, Tennessee. Stan, you're on the air. What do you think?
Well, it was once said that the business of America is business. And
yes.
I gather from your program today that the business of America is government.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's in the balance right here. Which way are you pushing? What are you hoping for, Stan?
What I gathered from your program is that the business of America is government. And that's my comment. Thanks for taking it.
I appreciate your call, Stan. I mean, Karen Tumbledy, that's the argument that gets made here. If you think that government's going to bail us out, you're wrong. We've got to have a strong economy. Government may be important in that, but there's too much of it right now. We're going to hear that all the way through 2012.
Well, and again, the earlier point I made is that, if there were a government shutdown, the kind of shape of it and the scope of it could actually reinforce the idea that government is not so necessary, especially if most government workers, and specifically the ones we count on to keep us safe, stay on the job and, you know, people just notice some inconvenience.
And that's exactly the point Michelle Bachmann was making earlier. It's just a slowdown. It's not a big deal. I mean, Jack, that feeds right in to a Tea Party vision of the world. Let's just have less.
You know, this whole way of looking at it, I think, opens up a new dimension on the pressures here behind the Republicans. I mean, they may feel, hey, people will wake up and say, as I think Phil Gramm said years ago about that, the first shutdown, who'll miss it? But, of course, people will miss it. I mean, we know that's true. Look at the airline story. I mean, the peeling airline. I mean, who's going to inspect that? Who's going to inspect the food? Who's going to look? You know, the sorts of things that are almost basic to our whole way of life, those supports, when they start, if the government were shut down for any period of time and that began to slow down, people's food would be, you know, the whole safety apparatus of America would be at stake. And people, it would come home to people how much government mattered to them.
It may, but people are, you know, they're really worried here. I mean, Arnold online says Obama and the left are spending this country into bankruptcy. Here's another listener online says, how about firing anybody that votes for deficit spending? You've got both these things going at once. Aaron in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. What do you think, Aaron?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that the Republicans were given an opportunity just a few weeks ago to vote down oil subsidies and agriculture subsidies, and they didn't, and that just shows how unserious they really are. It's about ideology.
Leaving subsidies on a big scale, what, agriculture, energy in that area, but then want to cut Planned Parenthood?
$80 billion in oil subsidies and agriculture subsidies, but $400 million to Planned Parenthood, that's a joke.
Aaron, I appreciate your call. Let me get one from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air, Peter.
Yes, you've all been touching on some things in different ways, but this really falls upon Americans and the voters. I mean, the question really becomes, we talk about all the things that we want out of government, all those amenities that would come with a social contract, all good and well, except we seem to be unwilling to pay a bloody red cent for it. And the country's really going to have to make up its mind. Does it want the kind of social structure, say, that we have in Canada and we've gotten to a degree in Europe? Do you wish to pay for that or do you not? And if you want lower taxes and reduced services, so be it. But it's going to have to be a discussion. It's going to have to be had soon. And my only viewpoint is simply watch out. Be very careful what you're doing. You need to have a reasoned discussion here, or else you're going to wind up with a country you're not going to like or a world you're not going to like.
But Peter, maybe a lot of people have already thought that through and decided the other way. You know, the last election,
well
the outcome said no thank you to Europe
really
and Canada.
We need to think critically, and this is not something that this country does very well at all. And also, there really needs to be some far-sighted thinking that, and along some levels that I'm not really sure has happened yet.
Peter, I appreciate your call. Appreciate your call, and I'm glad you're hopeful. I don't know where we're going. Dan, Washington, D.C. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. What are you looking at?
Eric Holder and this military tribunal decision to go ahead and try these alleged terrorists in a military tribunal instead of sending them through the civilian court.
This is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four others accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks. They were the Obama administration, Eric Holder, Attorney General, said we're going to do that in civilian courts in the United States. And this week they said no, back to Gitmo for the military tribunal. How about it, Dan? What do you think of it?
I'm saddened, to be honest. I think that Obama ran on closing down Gitmo. There was a sense of justice. The military tribunals under Bush, we know we're not done in a way that exemplified our justice system. I understand that it's wartime and you have different kind of courts, but all in all, our system relies on a judicial process that these alleged terrorists will not have access to. So we have our president once again shifting away from his progressive base and shifting to the Republican side. He's losing his base, and I think it's going to be a problem come election time next year if he doesn't start getting on track with what he ran on.
Dan, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here. That was a big move this week, a big change by the Justice Department. Chuck in Keene, New Hampshire. Chuck, you're on the air.
I am. You know, I'm a
long-time Democrat, but I'm never going to vote that way again. The Democratic Party is spending this country into bankruptcy. Now we're in Libya, and for no good reason. We can't afford it. The country's broke. We have a president who was critical of George Bush, and he's doing the exact same things. I wasn't a Bush fan. I will never vote Democrat again. This government should be shut down. I'm concerned about my grandkids and future generations, and none of my friends, my fellow Democrats, seem to care about it. They're very selfish.
Chuck, I appreciate your call. Jack, I mean, here, you know, back to Guantanamo for the trial. Mm-hmm. It's not Iraq, but it is into Libya. There's a Democrat saying too much spending and not the right moves on the things he cares about.
Yes, in defense of the president, Congress did essentially tie his hands in this not in my backyard rejection. But here is what a case that is on Guantanamo. No issue abroad has hurt us as much as that. Just the word itself, even illiterate people in Pakistan can sound it out. People know what it means. It's terribly hurtful for us in the ideological war with Al Qaeda, and yet NIMBY concerns have spiked it. And by people like Chuck Schumer, by the way, who really demagogued on this. But, you know, this question that Chuck raises, I agree, we have all this debt and deficit. I've just looked at a chart that shows that Obama spending is about 15% of current of the current deficit. The biggest part is, one, the recession, two, the Bush tax cut, and three, the defense, the two wars. Now, it's very hard to say that he's responsible for this tremendous deficit when you have those other factors involved.
Well, Karen, this is quite a week, and as you say, just a curtain raiser on a bigger debate going forward here. Do you see anything happening in this week, maybe in that 30-plus billion willingness by the Democrats here that might signal some kind of common understanding? I mean, there's a lot of Americans in the middle who are saying, and it's all over our comment pages, just work this out, please.
Well, I think that this, you know, as during the lame duck session, I mean, we could see some relationships being built here and potentially some trust being built here. But there was another event this week that is probably worth mentioning, which is that President Obama more or less formally announced he's running for re-election,
yes,
which, by the way, is further than any of his potential Republican opponents have gotten so far.
So he's up on the board saying he'll be there. A lot of fallout from this week, no doubt affecting those politics on both sides. The whole country kind of glued to the news right here. Karen Tumbley with The Washington Post, thanks in the midst of all this for being with us today. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Ron Brownstein with The National Journal, author of The Second Civil War. Ron, thank you very much for your time and thoughts today.
Sure.
Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.